Okay, thank you very much. I want to say at the start, I extend my appreciation to the Patrick family for setting this lecture up. I've enjoyed all of the speakers that we've had over the last few years. I also want to thank the selection panel for making this opportunity available to me this year. Well, I don't know if Lee mentioned it or not, but my title, slightly changed, is Carolina Bay's Interaction of Hydrology, Soils, and Plants in Natural Farmed and Restored Wetlands. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Carolina Bay, so I want to begin. I know you are. This wasn't a quiz, okay. All right, I know you were. All right, Darmody, I'm glad you're at the back. So let me go over very briefly what these are. This is this is an aerial photo from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, that was taken in 1930. And it shows the principal features of the bays. They're oval-shaped depressions, all oriented in the northwest to southeast direction. Around their rim, I think I better just use the pointer, they have a sand ridge, basically like an old beach. You can see they're quite plentiful. And the other thing you'll notice is, although they're called bays, they're not next to standing water. They're not on the coast or anything like that. They're back inland in our coastal plainland region. Their sizes vary from hundreds of meters to up to 11 kilometers. And the origin of these features is still not uniformly agreed upon. But they all have been wetlands and now are frequently used for wetland mitigation or restoration. And I want to talk about some of our experiences with those today. Now, again, a little bit more history. The Carolina Bays were first described in scientific literature in 1848. The term bay was published in Science in 1895, where L.C. Glenn noted that a bay is a perfectly flat, clayey area with a surface some 2 to 4 feet below the general level of the country. So by bay, we're talking about depressional areas, not anything tied to the coast. The term Carolina Bay was first used in 1933, for a publication dealing with how they formed. Now, the bays are quite abundant and show a fairly broad geographic distribution. They extend, I think, from southern New Jersey, this line probably should go up a little bit more, all the way down to northern Florida, and the heaviest concentration is in the Carolinas, as you might guess from the name. The original estimate was that over 500,000 of these bays occurs in this region, but I think current estimates put the number closer to 100,000. But still very, very common features. Now, one of the popular things is to propose methods for how these bays formed. You don't have to be a scientist to do that either to get something in the news. These are some of the explanations that have been proposed for how these bays formed. The most popular is meteor craters. Unfortunately, meteorite fragments have not been found. They've been searched for, but not been found. And I'm told that a meteor impact crater is round, not oval. On the other hand, I think that the best explanation, this is my opinion, is that these were all shallow ponds at some point of some unknown shape. And wind and wave action then created these oval-shaped features. Now, the basic idea, as I interpret it, is shown here. You have to have a strong prevailing wind, and let's say in our area, that will be from the southwest. It blows across an open body of water, piles up the water over here, and that sets up currents in this direction. And it's the currents, along with associated waves, that will then carve this feature into an oval shape. The direction of the prevailing wind, then, is perpendicular to the long axis of the bay, and as long as the wind stays in the same direction, the bays will all orient, in this case, in a northwest-southeast pattern. Now, today, most bays are not open bodies of water, although a few are. Since formation, most have filled in, and I'm just illustrating that with this pond-filling cycle that I think most of you are familiar with. You've got vegetation growing on the edge. The leaves and roots and stems fall in the water, building up an organic mat that gradually expands as more and more vegetation encroaches on the bay. It fills in the open water with organics. And today, I think we are in this phase, step four, for most of the bays that I've seen, where we have a dome shaped on some of the organics under forest, and mainly under forest vegetation. This is what a bay would look like today, at least that I've been walking through. A lot of trees and a lot of shrubs. In fact, you don't walk through a bay, you hack your way through them. It's a jungle-like vegetation, and I'll tell you, Tarzan would be feeling right at home if he saw some of our bays. They're quite abundant in some of our counties. In fact, in Bladen County, North Carolina, it looks like they occupy 25% or more. Now, as a result, people who are, well, farmers have wanted to develop these and have. They've purchased the land, drained them, and used many of them for agriculture. And since the 1980s, these have become popular candidates for wetland restoration. Now, of course, when you restore a wetland, when you turn a wetland into agriculture, you have to put in some ditches and drains. You lose your organic surface as it subsides or is lost through burning. You apply fertilizer and lime, and these chemicals then will leach into the soil at certain depths. And when we restore wetlands, these chemicals in some cases can come out. So there are many changes we have made to these wetland soils, and when we restore them, it creates certain problems. And I want to talk about what some of those problems are today. Now, my objective is to review research that's been conducted over the last 12 years on natural, farmed, and restored Carolina Bay wetlands, primarily at NC State, but we've had a large number of cooperators. The work was part of a large restoration study funded by the North Carolina Department of Transportation. They were under the gun for having to restore a large wetland area, and they got us in there to make sure it didn't fail. So my topics will be as shown here. I'll begin by discussing the hydrology and plant relationships of natural bays, move into chemical changes in a farm bay, then talk about the rhizosphere effect on phosphorus and iron release in a restored bay, and then close with a discussion of the phosphorus balance on a restored bay to see if any problems are waiting for us down the road. All right, let's look at the natural bays first and see basically what the natural condition is. And by natural, in this case, I mean there's no sign of drainage in the bays, and the trees appear to be 60 years old or more. Our objective was to quantify and compare the long-term, that is 40-year records of the hydrologies that were associated with four plant communities found in natural bays. Our goal was to help restorers. Now, normally in a restoration study, what people will do is they say, well, okay, I'm going to restore this wetland. I want to go to a natural wetland, the way it was before farming. I'll look at the trees, and then I'll plant those trees at my site. Now, we thought that was not particularly reliable. We're soil scientists and hydrologists. And so what we wanted to do is, let's say you know what the hydrology of your restored site is going to be through modeling, then pick from a list of trees and communities those that are best adapted not to the original hydrology but to the restored hydrology. And that's what we've tried to do. Okay? So come up with a practical tool for restorers to use. Now, we looked at three bays in southern North Carolina. They're given unique names, Charlie Long, Tatum Mill Pond, and Causeway Bay. Very thick vegetation, as I've said. Now, a study like this where you lay out plots is normally done by a randomized complete block or something. And that's when you have easy access to the site. But again, heavy vegetation, very wet organic soils is not easy to move through. So instead we use transects dug from the edge into the middle of the bay. We then put our plots in at different points with wells and pits and also describe soil the plants for all the plots. Now I should mention that the work I'm talking about has been done by a number of students and other cooperators. And this is the botanist working, and the botanist work. And so I want to give credit where credit is due. They identified four plant communities, and each community has a suite of unique trees. So we have pond pine woodland, non-riverine swamp forest, bay forest, and high pocosin along our transects. This is a transect through one of the bays. Now, on the x-axis, I've got distance, 0 to 500 meters. On the y-axis, I've got depth, 0 to 180 centimeters. And you can see the plant communities that we found along this transect. Now, notice that this is the top of the mineral surface, and it has a configuration much like you'd expect from a shallow pond or lake, going from the shallow water to the deep. And the deep, in fact, the whole thing is now filled in with this organic soil. Let's assume that this is a typical pattern, and we then put in our plots with wells, as shown here, along the transect, not spaced evenly or anything, because we tried to fit a certain number of, if we had a long stretch of one plant community, we put in more plots and less plots when there was a shorter stretch. All right, soil taxonomy did not help us describe, or I should say relate the soils, relate plant communities to soils across three bays, because there were just too many soil series. So instead, we broke the soils into four groups based on the thickness of the organic soil surface. So we'll have mineral soils, organic surface less than 20 centimeters thick, histic, where it's 20 to 40 centimeters, shallow organics, and then deep organic soils, where the organic material goes down at least 200 centimeters. The underlying material will be sands, loams, and layers of clay. Now, the botanist said this is the distribution of plant communities along a generic bay. So around the outside, where we have mineral soils, we generally have pond pine woodland. As we go further in into the histic soils, where that is just a histic epipedon or 20 centimeters to 40 centimeters of organic surface, we'll get pond pine as well. Further in, before I get there, swinging around. If you are in shallow organic soils, but soils with high extractable phosphorus, we find non-riverine swamp forest. And then the deeper soils in the middle of the bay are bay forest on the deep organics, and then Pocosin in this case on deep organics next to the bay forest. Here are some of the plant canopy, here are the canopy characteristics, giving you the types of trees. Now, not being a botanist, I really don't care about the Latin names. We'll just use the common names. For dominant species across all four plant communities now, we've got pond pine in the pond pine woodland, bald cypress, swamp tupelo, Atlantic white cedar in the non-riverine swamp forest. We've got a mixture of trees from other communities in the high Pocosin, pond pine and loblolly and red bays, and then the sweet red and loblolly bays for the bay forest. You can see the height of the trees in the next row. The tallest trees were found in the non-riverine swamp forest, and the shortest trees were in the bay forest, deepest in the wetland. Basal area, and I had to look this up, it's the cross-sectional area that the trunks occupy in a given plot. It was highest again in the non-riverine swamp forest, lowest in the Pocosin, and the bay forest wasn't far behind. Now, with the Pocosin, we thought might have been a community in transition, meaning it burned 60 years ago or some time ago, and is now the trees are gradually recovering and moving towards one of these other plant communities, in our case, probably a bay forest, although I'm not certain. Now, for soil characteristics across the plant communities again, we're looking at organic soil depth, and it ranged from 23 in the pond pine woodland to over 180 centimeters deep in the bay forest. Now, the unique thing about the plant communities was, again, we had one with slightly higher phosphorus levels, available phosphorus, 18 megagrams per cubic decimeter than the other, and we think this is significant. Again, bay forest, high Pocosin, and pond pine woodland all had lower amounts. Now, our main interest, of course, as I said, was modeling the hydrology. So we do this in a number of steps. We start with water level. We have our wells in each of the plots, record water daily water table levels over time, also measure rainfall at the sites, and the water table levels are for each plant community. We also have to estimate evapotranspiration and collect soil data like saturated hydraulic conductivity, pore size distribution, depth to impermeable layers, and that sort of thing. And we use all that information to develop and calibrate hydrologic models. We like DrainMod in North Carolina, at least at NC State. And this model simulates the water table levels that we would get in a well. So the data are easily interpretable. And so we calibrate our DrainMod models and such that when we plug in temperature and rainfall data, it will compute a water table level. It does it on a daily basis. And so what we do next is plug in 40 years of daily temperature and rainfall data to get 40 years of daily water table measurements. And we summarize the data and compare it to each of the plant communities. Summarize in the sense of average water table depth, duration of ponding, things like that. And then we look for statistical differences across the communities. Here's the water table depth distribution over the 40-year period for the four plant communities to begin. to begin with. I've got ponded, water table within 0 to 30 centimeters, 30 to 45, and greater than 45. And here's the percent of total days over the 40-year period we fell into each of those categories. The orange bar is pond pine woodland, moving to non-riverine swamp forest in blue, a high Pocosin in green, and then bay forest in yellow. Well, you can see that all the communities except pond pine woodland enjoyed ponded soil conditions. They liked their sites were ponded for over 80% of the time. Now, the pond pine woodland didn't exactly like a dry site. It had a water table within 30 centimeters of the surface for over 60% of the time. The water tables did not fall, really, at these sites for very long. You occasionally had a drought over time, but overall, and for most years, these were very, very wet sites, with the pond pine, that community on the edge of the wetland, being the driest. Now, when I say that the other communities were ponded, I don't mean we had a lake. You know that a forested area, particularly with organic soils, is very hummocky, like I'm showing here, and the distance between a high and a low in the depression is about 30 centimeters. And so when I say we're ponded, I mean these depressional areas had water in them, but that the highs were always above water. The reason we put our well, as shown here in the lows, is that the highs were occupied by trees, and we didn't want to cut them down just to put in a well. But we definitely did not have a lake or a pond at any of these locations. Now, we did the statistical analysis on various hydrologic parameters. Here's where we found different significant differences at the 05 level. Again, my plant communities are shown across the top. The pond pine woodland was the only community that stood out statistically based on hydrology. It had significantly different hydrologies than the other three plant communities, which were basically identical. So for groundwater inflow, it was 15% of the input, very significant for pond pine woodland, but not for the other sites. Average water table depth, minus 15 centimeters for the pond pine woodland, but ponded for the other areas, other communities. Percent of time ponded, 24%. For pond pine, but 82% for the other plant communities. And average consecutive days of ponding, 15 or very, very short for pond pine, and then 110 for the remainder. So again, we couldn't separate non-riverine swamp forest, high Pocosin, or bay forest on the basis of hydrology. Now, our goal was to come up with a table that, of recommendations that restorers might use. And this is work from Pete Caldwell. Actually, all of it's from Pete Caldwell that he published in an Ag Engineering Journal. So we have two categories to pick a plant community to use at a restored site. Let's say we know the hydrology, and we'd also have to know the soil type. And that's basically organic soil thickness. And hydrology and soil thickness, organic soil thickness, are all related, so it's not like we're looking at two different things. We also need to have a fertility parameter we felt, high phosphorus, let's say an ag field, or low phosphorus, as I defined earlier. Well, if you've got ponded conditions for long periods and organic soils, both deep and shallow, we would suggest non-riverine swamp forest where you have high amounts of available phosphorus. Say you're restoring an ag field. If you have low phosphorus levels and you're ponded for long periods, we'd go with the bay forest. Possibly a Pocosin if it's not a transition community, but I like the bay forest. Now, if you're ponded for short periods and you have thinner organic surfaces or mineral soil material, then we would go with pond pine woodland in both cases. So this is the type of information we thought would be very useful, and if funding were available, we would continue to do it. But we've put that on the back burner right now, and it's as far as we've gotten so far, but I certainly would like to encourage the rest of you to keep up this kind of study, because I think more information on the detailed information on hydrology of these communities and others is needed. All right, well, let's leave the natural wetlands and turn to the drained wetlands that are farmed and look at some of the changes that occur. I'll be talking about Juniper Bay. It's our main study site, again, in North Carolina. And if you're not from the United States, North Carolina is on the East Coast. This would be the Atlantic Ocean. And we're about halfway between Washington, D.C. and Atlanta, or Washington, D.C. and Disney World. All right. Our bay is right in here. It's about a mile long and about a mile and a half wide. It's a restoration site, a mitigation site, because the North Carolina DOT had to replace wetland area when it built this road through a natural wetland, or at least partially natural wetland. This shows the topography. Juniper Bay obviously is right in here. On the west, it's bordered by a sand ridge, as on the east. The lowest position in this landscape would be the Lumber River over here. So the wetland itself is, or the bay itself, is actually in an intermediate topographic position. I think what the prairie pothole guys would call a flow-through wetland, where we're getting inflow from the ridges and then outflow through the edges of the bay, as shown there. Now, it's a very flat area, and we'll discuss hydraulic gradient later in the talk, but when you're perfectly flat or nearly flat, it's almost a zero hydraulic gradient. So groundwater, except for the ditches, if the ditches weren't there, groundwater movement would be almost zero. Now, for a general soils map, I've got this. We've got organic soils in a large mass in the center of the bay. They're haplosaprous. We've got mineral soils around the bay here, the spodosols and the ultosols, basically aquads and alquats. And then, of course, the sandy rim, where we have the enosols and the ultosols. Just around the edge of the organic soils, we have soils with histocapopetons, where the organic layers are 20 to 40 centimeters thick. Incidentally, this site was drained for 30 years by the time we got there, and I won't be able to talk about our research on subsidence, but the organic soils we felt subsided by about 1.2 meters at the site since drainage. Now, in that subsidence process, the organic soils became to look like this. We have a very black OA horizon, OAP horizon from agriculture and tillage and drying with a strong granular structure. Below that, we've got this brown-colored material, that organic material. It's a muck with a massive structure. This stuff has not had much aeration in it, although we did not make detailed measurements. It's called colloidal muck. If you take the brown stuff to the lab and dry it, it actually turns black. So we've got basically a form of oxidized and then probably less oxidized material, and then mineral material down here. Here are the soil types, basically, at Juniper Bay. 40 to 60 centimeters of organic surface in our shallow organic soils. Again, in the deep organics, we were down to about 2 meters. But at Juniper Bay, we've only got about 60 centimeters left. So we've lost about 1.4 meters of organic material through subsidence. The second group would be mineral, which included the histic, 0 to 40 centimeters of organic surface, the aquults and the aquads. Now, Juniper Bay was drained at three different time periods, 30 years on the left, 20 years in the middle, and then 15 years on the upper right. And so basically we had a chrono sequence that allowed us to study agricultural effects over time in this particular wetland. Now, it was drained intensively, as shown here. The water is all draining to a central outlet, which I'll refer to throughout the talk. It's the main drainage outlet, the only drainage outlet at the site. We fit it with a couple of V-notch weirs as well as a well to measure water levels. And we measured outflow from the bay both pre- and post-restoration at this structure. Now, I don't have time to talk about many of the agricultural changes, and so I'm going to focus on chemical changes from fertilizer and lime. The objective of this work was to determine how deeply fertilizer and lime additions increased nutrient levels over those of the original soil for the time periods that the site was in agriculture. So we put out a number of pits to collect samples from the area drained 30 years, 20 years, and 15 years, as shown here. Now, I've got the data summarized here as differences in nutrients over time between natural bays and Juniper Bay. The shaded boxes are what I want you to look at. And let me just walk you through this. We've got three elements here, extractable phosphorus, calcium, and manganese. And this is an organic soil. The depths are shown here. Now let's go to those gray boxes. The gray indicates where we found a statistical difference between Juniper Bay and the natural soils at a given depth. So for phosphorus, we found that at 15 centimeters, actually 0 to 15 centimeters, after 15 years in agriculture, we had significantly higher phosphorus levels at the bay compared to the natural site. So after 15 years, we did not see significant differences below 15 centimeters, a fairly small depth increment. At 20 years in agriculture, we saw significant differences down to about 32 centimeters, and after 30 years, all the way down to 87 centimeters. So 30 years produced big impacts, but 15, relatively minor. Now, I want you to notice that the mineral soils come in on this site at 75 to 80 centimeters, I'd say about 90 centimeters, to remember, because we'll use that in the next slide. For calcium, similar results at 15 years after agriculture, significantly higher amounts, down to 15 centimeters, but no deeper. For 20 years, down to 75 centimeters, and for 30 years, all the way down to a meter or more. And we saw the same thing, basically, for manganese. Now, I'm going to focus on phosphorus first and give you some of the extractable data. Extractable phosphorus at the surface, at the x-axis versus soil depth. The red is the natural bay. You can see that our phosphorus levels in the farmed areas are about 5 to 6 times higher than what you found in the natural area. And what I want to mention is that, in general, we didn't see a lot of deep penetration, as I said, for 15 to 20 years. But at 30 years, we started developing the bulge here at around 80 centimeters. And we think this is where the phosphorus is being held up or retarded in the mineral soil layers, possibly by aluminum or iron oxides. For calcium, we didn't see the bulge, but again, much higher levels, relatively speaking, in the bay soils with a nice pattern from 15, 20 to 30 compared to the natural area. So deep penetration of phosphorus in particular that we were going to watch when we restored the bay, because it is possible this stuff would be coming out. And again, this is work from Justin Ewing. All right, let's talk about restoration. Juniper Bay was restored in 2005. As is traditional in our area, the Department of Transportation planted trees at the bay in 2004 to give them 1 year to equilibrate. They planted pond pine woodland around the outside and then a bay forest community at the inside. Where you see the ponded water is where they scraped off some of the material to fill the ditches. Now, this shows the ditch filling operation in more detail. The main canals were filled as shown here. The minor ditches were plugged just at one end. The perimeter ditch was left open to drain out this structure. Remember, if you plug the ditches, the water table will rise, of course, but rise to the original soil surface. If you've subsided 1.2 meters, that means the water level will rise 1.2 meters across the organic soils and create a lake, killing all your trees. We don't want that, so the perimeter ditch was left open as long as the beavers permitted. Now, here's what happened after this is phosphorus coming out of the surface water at the outflow structure. 2002 to 2014, restoration in 2005. I've got milligrams of dissolved reactive phosphorus, milligrams per liter on the y-axis here. The 0.10 shows where the mark of demarcation. If the phosphorus levels are below that, it's probably not going to create eutrophication in surface waters downstream. If we're above it, you got to watch for excessive phosphorus levels and algae blooms. Well, you can see that after restoration, phosphorus started coming out as has been previously reported. So we applied for a USDA grant because we had a pending environmental crisis here. We got the grant for a multi-scale study to evaluate this process in more detail. And I'm glad I got the grant in about 2009, because subsequent to that, the phosphorus levels fell back to basically pre-restoration levels, and we had no problem. Of course, we didn't tell the USDA that. All right. So our multi-scale study, the topics are shown here. We started with a particle size scale to identify the phosphorus forms, moved into a rhizosphere scale where we studied the reactions around plant roots. We then moved to a field scale where we developed a phosphorus budget, and still in progress is a regional scale. We're looking to see how typical the bays are that we studied in our region. Are they farmed? Are they drained by streams? To get a better feel for any potential crises coming down the pipe. Well, for particle size scale, Dean Hesterberg took samples, four samples, two from a mineral soil, the spodosol, two from a histosol, ran them up to Brookhaven National Labs, and did a phosphorus Zanes analysis. And here are the results of the Zanes spectra. This is the 0 to 15 centimeters. He found that for the mineral soils, most of the phosphorus was held to aluminum oxides. Non-crystalline oxides in blue, crystalline in light blue, and then organic phosphorus in yellow. For the histosols, he had phosphorus absorbed to crystalline aluminum oxides, a bunch in organic phosphorus, as you might expect. But it was a surprise to me that we had a bunch as iron-bound phosphorus or phosphate. And so this is the stuff that we would expect to come out when we create the wetlands. Now, if you restore the wetland, you restore anaerobic conditions, and basically this is the process for those of you maybe not familiar with it. The phosphorus is held, a phosphate anion is held to an iron oxide bridge, as shown here. It bonds the negatively charged phosphorus to negatively charged clay particle or colloid. When you reduce the iron, it goes into solution and releases the phosphorus to solution, and that could contribute to that bulge in phosphorus we saw after restoration. Now, aluminum oxides are not safe for holding phosphorus either. Dissolved organic carbon in the water is negatively charged, and that could also displace the phosphorus and release it. So we had two processes that could be going on releasing phosphorus at our site. Now, I'm going to change gears, go up to the rhizosphere scale now, and ask, where is this phosphorus being released in the soil? Now, we thought that most of the release would occur in the rhizosphere, and that is that soil area, that soil around a root that's rich in organics and microorganisms. And that was just ripe for reducing iron or creating DOC and getting that phosphorus to come off. I thought there'd be a lot more output there than the soil matrix, which doesn't have the roots. So we wanted to study reactions around roots and then back in the matrix. And then our objectives here were to compare phosphorus concentration, compare concentrations of dissolved phosphorus and reduced iron in the matrix and rhizosphere of bald cypress trees. The study was done by Colby Moorborg, and he did it in the greenhouse using rhizotrons. These are basically plexiglass-walled boxes like giant ant farms. We've done all our studies in those for a two-year period. And we had two soil treatments, Eric aliquots for mineral soils and the organic soils, typical haplosaporus, and both came from Juniper Bay. And two plant treatments, if you will, one planted, which gave us rhizospheres, and another unplanted, which gave us the matrix. Just some soils data. Total soil phosphorus was a little bit higher in the mineral soils. Big difference in organic carbon percentage, as you might guess, 20% versus 4. We had a pH of about 6 in the mineral, around 4 in the organic, as a result of liming primarily. Texture was loamy sands in the mineral, muck in the organic, and the bulk densities were packed to field bulk density, determined at the site. Okay, we grew the boxes at an angle to let the roots grow down along the face of the box till they reach the bottom. Then we put the boxes upright, and Colby saturated them for 128 days. For sampling, we sampled three layers, as shown here, roughly top, middle, and bottom. We could see the roots for the planted treatments, and so Colby drilled holes right next to the root and inserted a Rizon pore water sampler, basically a big little tensiometer, to suck water out into an evacuated bottle through a syringe needle. We also drilled in and put platinum electrodes right into the rhizosphere to measure redox potential. Well, here's some of the data. This is redox potential for the mineral soil. There's no plant or time interaction, so we averaged all treatments, that is the planted and the, all depth treatments for this particular site. Now let me give you a couple of lines for reference. I've got redox potential on the y-axis, days of saturation on the x. And the rhizosphere is in the open circles and the matrix in the solid dots. But you'll notice that for the rhizosphere, there was a strong rhizosphere effect. In 20 days, we are already into the sulfate-reducing zone, generating probably hydrogen sulfide. Once we got down to the sulfate-reduced zone, though, it remained constant. The redox potential basically remained constant for the remainder of the study. In the matrix, there was also a decline, but it was more gradual, and it took about 80 days for us to get into the sulfate-reduced range. But basically, this is what we would expect. More organics in the mineral soil in the rhizosphere, so a steeper drop in redox potential, as you had more bugs taking out oxygen and reducing the iron and finally reducing the sulfate. Now, we did have iron sulfides formed in this soil. This is not the soil that we studied. It's a similar one, red sand. I just want to illustrate the effect. These are pond pine roots growing down to the bottom. These roots were grown on the left under unsaturated conditions. We then saturated the box as shown on the right, and you can see after 17 days, we started getting black color forming along the rhizosphere. This marked the rhizosphere very well. But the main point I wanted to show is the black we know now is iron sulfides. And so we confirmed it chemically, and when you drain the box, the black color goes away. So I just want to illustrate that we do have iron sulfides in these soils. Here's the change in reduced iron that we noticed following saturation. I've got mineral soils at the top, organic soils at the bottom. You can see that this is reduced iron on a log scale. For the rhizosphere, again, an open circle, so you can see there was a strong rhizosphere effect initially, at least up to 20 days, where the much more iron was put into solution. After 20 days, though, the iron contents fell, and we believe that's due to that precipitation of iron sulfides. We were in the iron sulfide or the sulfate-reducing zone after 20 days, as I showed you earlier. Now, for the matrix, it was a more gradual rise up to about 80 days or so, and then it declined, probably due to iron sulfide formation. In the organic soils, we did not see a strong rhizosphere effect, and I think that's because you had 20% organic carbon versus 12. Plenty of carbon here to for the bugs to operate even in the matrix and start reducing iron oxides and getting it into solution. Again, it looks like we got a decrease after time, probably due to iron sulfides. Now, dissolved total phosphorus. This is the key for us. We found, let's see, I'm looking at data now at 0 to 22 centimeters and 41 to 59 centimeters. Organic and mineral soils were combined. You'll see that there was not a strong rhizosphere at 0 to 22 centimeters, at least up to 60 days. But after that, in the rhizosphere, we saw a sharp drop in phosphorus levels, dissolved total phosphorus, again, by the way, on a log scale, but a steady increase in the matrix. So it looked like the rhizosphere was actually sucking out the phosphorus, in other words, it was coming out as plant uptake, but also if any of the rhizosphere was oxidized, from the roots bringing air through a parenchyma, we could be oxidizing iron and, again, sorbing phosphorus to it. So, again, the rhizosphere were basically acting as a sink for phosphorus, at least in the upper layers. In the deeper layers, we didn't see a strong rhizosphere effect either, but here we didn't see a drop in phosphorus. So the rhizospheres were not sucking that phosphorus out, if I can use that term. And the reason is the roots up here seemed to be active. These down here were basically were inactive. Now what happened was when we grew the roots initially under unsaturated conditions. When we saturated the box, the plant immediately started new roots growing at the surface. So these new roots had parenchyma in them. They were adapted to the anaerobic conditions. And so as a result, were functioning even underwater. Down here, the plant didn't bother putting roots deeper. And these roots were basically inactive, and hence, you didn't see a rhizosphere effect. At least that's our explanation. All right, field scale. Remember, we started this study when we saw that phosphorus coming out of solution. And so our concern was that it would go off into the freshwater bodies and creating huge algae blooms like we see here in China. Alternatively, we really wanted it to go get sucked up into the trees. Now, our objectives for this phase of the work were to determine the net change in total phosphorus to a depth of 1 meter across Juniper Bay. We used two time periods here, 2005, which is pre-restoration, 2013, which is post-restoration. We also wanted to quantify the oxygen fluxes coming into and out of that bay. I should say up front, this is again work of Colby Moorberg, first PhD. This is our rough or initial phosphorus balance. Our inputs would be atmospheric phosphorus coming in through rainfall or dry deposition, groundwater inflow. Our outputs would be that taken up by plants, that held in litter, that fell from the trees, the leaves, that coming out in surface outflow, and that coming out as groundwater outflow. And we're looking at a change in soil phosphorus over time. Now, I've taken the balance and put it in equation form down here. We have an error term for that amount which is left over. Now, the groundwater outflow and inflow really could not be measured separately because we had that open perimeter ditch. It was taking these components, it was intercepting these components and taking it out as surface outflow at our site. And so we just combined all those three into one outflow term along with our error term. Okay, so change in total phosphorus. Just want to illustrate that we did take enough samples. We sampled 700 locations pre-restoration, 0 to 15, 30, 15 to 30 centimeters, along with 19 pits down to 1 meter. For post-restoration, we didn't get quite as enthusiastic. We resampled 138 surface locations, and we sampled all the pits. Just moving ahead very quickly, we also had 19 vegetation plots scattered around the bay that were used to estimate total biomass and then total phosphorus in the biomass, as well as total phosphorus in any of the litter. Now let's move to the results. Here's the change in total phosphorus over time. I know there's a lot of numbers on there, but I just want to convince you that at least we looked for differences. We looked at mineral soils as one group versus organics, and here are data for three depths in each category. Now, in 2005, our estimate is that you had 234 megagrams of phosphorus in that bay. 2013, we had 216 megagrams in the bay, so we lost about 18 megagrams. Well, the loss was not uniform across the depths. Some of these changes were positive, others were negative. We ran the statistics on this, of course, and it turns out there was no significant difference in phosphorus loss. And so for the balance, we initially just said, then change in total phosphorus over 8 years is zero. Okay? Kind of disappointing. But I don't think taking more samples would have changed it. Now, we do see changes across the bay in total phosphorus, and that's illustrated here. For three depths, 15, 30, and 100 centimeters. Now, we've got a bunch of colors. These are prepared by Colby again. Just remember that the reds and oranges are losses. The blues, dark and light, are gains, as in here. So 15 centimeters, we had substantial areas of loss, particularly right in here, which appeared to be being sucked up maybe by the outflow structure, or at least related to that. And the perimeter ditch is coming around here, of course. So maybe it was taking out some of that initial phosphorus from that depth. At 30 centimeters, we had a large spot where phosphorus increased for some reason, a little bit lower around the perimeter ditch. And at 100 centimeters, generally a loss around this perimeter ditch here. So no consistent pattern, certainly nothing that we would hang our hat on, try to explain. But there was no significant loss from a statistical standpoint across the entire bay. Now, if you look at our numbers, this is what we found for the total phosphorus balance. 2 megagrams were coming in through the atmosphere with rainfall and dry deposition. 7 megagrams were taken up by the vegetation. 1 megagram went up, or is being stored in the litter, but only 0.5 is coming out as outflow, and that's good news. So we're really not moving a lot of phosphorus out of the bay. Our error term, the leftover, is 6.5 megagrams of total phosphorus. I don't think we're missing any major outflow component, to be frank. I don't think we're losing it deeply through vertical movement because there's clay layers under there. My guess is that this reflects the actual amount of total soil phosphorus that was lost to these other components. And we just don't have enough samples to actually document it. Anyway, that's how I'm interpreting a loss of 6.5 megagrams. In the big scheme, remember there's over 200 megagrams in the bay, so this is less than 3% of the phosphorus unaccounted for at this time. Well, why isn't more phosphorus leaving the site? Well, the groundwater is not moving, and the surface ditch is not moving much water either. This wetland is not drained by a stream. If it was, a lot of the water would be moving to that stream and the phosphorus with it, because the phosphorus is in solution. So we don't have a draining a stream cutting through the wetland. The site also has a low hydraulic gradient. It's almost flat, and so not a lot of groundwater is moving towards that perimeter ditch. The bay is basically acting like an isolated wetland, all right? It's losing about 1 megagram of phosphorus per year, largely to plant uptake. Now, we got 200 megagrams of phosphorus in the bay now. We're losing 1 megagram per year. So how many years is it going to take to reduce this, the phosphorus in the bay, to half? It's going to take about 100 years to go from 200 to 100 megagrams. And so the bay is going to be undergoing slow changes, it looks like, over time, but nothing drastic. Now, let me summarize the talk going back to the hydrology plant study. We found that hydrology alone seems to explain the distribution of the pond pine woodland in natural bays. Hydrology and available phosphorus might be explaining the distribution of our non-riverine swamp forest. So we don't think that hydrology by itself is the sole answer. And hydrology and soil type, in other words, deep organic soils, on deep organic soils, may explain bay forest distribution. What I'm driving at here is a wet, deep organic soil doesn't have a lot of bearing capacity. And I think tall trees will fall over, and that's why the bay forest is a community with the short trees. All right, the bay forest, deep organics, just do not have a lot of bearing capacity. At any rate, that's our idea. For Colby's rhizotron work, he showed that the rhizotrons enhanced iron dissolution in mineral soils with 4% organic carbon. There was no effect in the organic soils. Root uptake of phosphorus and possibly oxidation of the rhizosphere reduce phosphorus concentrations. So the phosphorus is actually, the rhizospheres are actually a sink for phosphorus in these soils. And for the phosphorus balance, farm wetlands, those not drained by streams, I would think are ideal candidates for wetland mitigation, because little surface or groundwater is leaving the site. If phosphorus is in solution, it should pose very little problem to water quality off-site in these wetlands. I want to say thanks, before I close, to the students, staff, and faculty from NC State's Department of Forestry, Soil Science, Botany, and Bio-Ag Engineering. It looks like most of those are in the audience today, or make up the audience today. We had Dan Richter at Duke help us, along with Byron Jenkinson, formerly with Purdue. And then Jim Doolittle did a lot of ground-penetrating radar at our site, which I wasn't able to report on today, and certainly want to thank them, along with all our funders. Now, it said we're supposed to end the talk with a bang, and here's mine. If you ever wondered what a beaver dam looks like when it's blown up, this is it, just after detonation. It's part of our management structure. We had to hire a USDA person to come through periodically and remove beaver dams, as well as the beavers, from the perimeter ditch. And for the big dams, he literally blows them up with a mixture of ammonium nitrate and racing fuel, and that was one of the best times I had at the bay setting this thing off. All right, well, that concludes my presentation. Thank you for being here, and if you have any questions, I'll try to answer.
We have some time for any questions. Kurt?
So when you're looking at your phosphorus, I was just thinking, you know, we've done some
No, That was not part of our goal, but it's a good idea. In other words, the question was, have we looked at different phosphorus forms? No, but I think we probably should. Yeah.
Other questions?
Yeah, Bruce. I don't. If the Delmarva bays are oval and oriented in the same direction, I would say it's the same thing. But I really would have, if this is a trick question, I want to have time to go back and look.
That's not my trick question.
Oh, you got another one. All right.
I have not spent much time in Carolina Bay, so I don't have an opinion on that.
All right.
Don't
know. I'd have to look it up. But if they're oval-shaped and oriented and have a sandy rim, I would say that's the same process formed these things. How they would be different than that, I really can't say. Yeah.
Now, Mike, the one graphic you showed with the concentric rings.
Yeah.
And you said the riverine swamp forest has elevated phosphorus. Was that naturally, was that on the reference site?
That was on the reference site. Now, whether that's natural or caused by some other phenomena, I can't say. And I'm supposed to repeat the question. So the question is, why is non-riverine swamp forest having higher phosphorus levels in natural bays? I don't know. I can't say.
Bob?
Yeah.
Mike, do you have radiocarbon dates in the bays for these things?
We do. The question was, do we have radiocarbon dates? We took cores down to 50 feet. And, Bob, I have to go back and look at an earlier version of the talk. I can say that the oldest age we got is listed as greater than 35,000 years, and that's in a muck. Did you say how old or how deep?
Old.
35,000 years in a muck. That's probably at around 20 feet. Moving up towards the surface, we get into, this is on wood fragments, probably cypress, that went to 8,000 years, and then within a meter of the surface, we could pick up 2,000 years. But I would say within 10 feet, we were getting 8,000-year-old ages, and then 35,000 below that. What do you think of that?
Anything else?
Yeah. Okay, the question is, could subsidence over time be a factor for not finding significance in total P? I don't think so in this case. The subsidence occurred over 30 years. Most subsidence, by our estimates, occurred in the first 15 years. So this would be 15 years even beyond that. I don't think we had a lot of subsidence occurring from 2005 to 2013. Okay? If we'd started earlier, maybe that would have been a factor. All right? Good question. Anything else?
Jim.
Yeah. Have you done any coring just outside the rims of the...
Yes.
What are you finding there?
Pretty much the same thing on the inside. This was work done by Bill Zanner, who really didn't complete it because, unfortunately, he died. Find the same thing. Going from 0 to 50 feet, you've basically got alternating layers of sands and clays with occasional layers of muck in there. And now the thicknesses of these layers will vary. At 20 feet, we found a continuous layer of clay, basically, and it almost looked varve. In other words, it had the oxidized version was red and then gray, you know, like varve glacial clays maybe formed over a lake, ice-covered lake or something. But above that, it was pretty much alternating sands and clays.
These are probably 1,000 years old as far as formation of
it. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
They're about the whale waddles. It would be about 8,000 years old. Their formation came about 10,000 years old.
I have to be careful. I have to say that the formation probably was less than 8,000 years ago. But that 35,000-year age down below is in a layer of muck. So these bays may have been forming since for 35,000 years, but sometimes maybe they were buried and then reformed in the new sediment. I really don't know. But the difference in sediments from the surface to 50 feet, my spot checking made it sound like it's not that much different. So there may have been multiple periods of formation. I don't know.
Whitehead found in some of these bays, he found 35,000 to 40,000 years. Way in the base.
Okay.
But the vegetation, the organic matter, we just finished the California DD. It was 8,800 years for the more modern stuff, in a sense. Whitehead found 30,000 years, way, way below.
Okay, that's basically what we found, but it wasn't, I don't think we were way, way below for 35. I'd have to go back and check. It's on an older version that I didn't bring with me. But the ages are... Whiteheads?
No, yours. Yours wasn't used in 20 feet.
It went down to 50 in some cases.
Where was 35,000 years?
See, that was pretty shallow. I think it started around 15 feet. But I want to go back and look, because I'm not trusting my memory. All right, but it's a good question. Anything else?
Well, in recognition of Mike's wonderful talk, we have a plaque from SSSSA, and again, we want certainly thank the Patrick family for its support of this talk and the Wetland Soils Division and its activities.
Right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Okay.